And now there came both mist and snow, and it grew wondrous cold, and ice mast high came floating by, as green as emerald, and through the drifts the snowy cliffs did send a dismal sheen, nor shapes of men nor beasts we ken, the ice was all between. The ice was here, the ice was there, the ice was all around. It cracked and growled and roared and howled like noises in a sound. At length did cross an albatross. Through the fog it came, as if it had been a Christian soul. We hailed it in God's name. It ate the food it ne'er had et, and round it flew, and ice did split with thunder fit. The helmsman steered us through, and a good south wind sprung up behind. The albatross did follow, and every day, for food or play, came to the mariner's hollow. In mist or cloud, on mast or shroud, it perched for vespers nine, whiles all the night through fog smoke white glimmered the white moonshine. God save thee, ancient mariner, from the fiends that plague thee thus. Why look'st thou so? With my crossbow I shot the albatross. The sun now rose upon the right, and out of the sea came he, still hid in mist, and on the left went down into the sea. And the good south wind still blew behind, but no sweet bird did follow, nor any day for food or play came to the mariner's hollow. And I had done a hellish thing, and it would work him woe, for all averred I had killed the bird that made the breeze to blow. Ah, wretch, they said, the bird to slay that made the breeze to blow. Nor dim nor red, like God's own head, the glorious sun uprist. Then all averred I had killed the bird that brought the fog and mist. 'Twas right, said they, such birds to slay that bring the fog and mist.
Hi, I'm Alexa Sand.
And I'm Ian McInnes.
And this is Real Fantastic Beasts.
Because we believe that learning about animals and history and literature and art helps us understand our place among our fellow creatures today. And if our audience is at all familiar with the story that I read, they will know that this is a very late creation. The albatross is supposed to be the most legendary bird, but that legend is a very late creation, right, Alexa?
So you were reading from a poem by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. So when was that written, Ian?
That was written somewhere between 1797 and 1798, and it was published in 1798, which is late for us, very late.
Yeah. It's fairly early modern. I think we're definitely talking about the Enlightenment here.
So why did it take so long for an albatross to become a legendary bird?
Well, let's think about the albatross, the real beast. Where do albatrosses, of which there are some 30-odd species, I think, where do they live, typically?
They live in the Pacific and in the Southern Ocean.
That is correct.
Which means...
So, for the Middle Ages, for the classical world, they didn't exist because they weren't in the world as it was known to those people.
But some albatrosses so wander into
medieval
Europe occasionally?
That is true. In the 1950s and 60s, there was an albatross who was frequently spotted in England and Northern Europe. His name was Albert the Albatross. He'd been blown off course by a very severe storm in the South Atlantic. And he was looking for a mate, actually, up there in the North, rather unsuccessfully. He was sort of pestering gannet colonies in the North Atlantic because gannets maybe look a little bit to an albatross like an albatross. And so he was spotted over a period of dozens of years. Albatrosses can live to be into their 70s, maybe 80s.
At least.
Very long lifespan.
At least, yeah. We don't really know exactly how long they
can go. We don't really know for sure. Right. Right. Yeah. The current oldest albatross is somewhere around 70. She was tagged as a hatchling 70 years ago or 71 years ago now.
You would think that Albert would be able to, with all the distance they could fly, you would think that Albert would be able to eventually find other albatrosses. But albatrosses, when they fledge, when they leave the nest, That is the moment which they also leave their parents. So parent birds will come back to the nest and find that their baby has flown. So there's no sort of learning process from the adult birds. Apparently it's all built in. So if it goes wrong, I can imagine that's it. You know, there they are. They don't know where to go. They're never going to learn that thing because they've got no opportunities to do that. Poor Albert.
Well, back to the Middle Ages and pre-modern times, the albatross was not part of the sort of imaginary. You don't find the albatross in the Physiologus or in any of the medieval bestiary traditions. There's no classical literary tradition about the albatross, which for medieval writers would have been a pretty serious obstacle to having a medieval tradition because of the importance of authority. So yeah, it really isn't until the Age of Discovery and then, of course, Coleridge's poem that we begin to have a kind of mythology of the albatross.
So it's true that there's not, they literally cannot know the albatross since the albatross does not exist in Europe. But it seems to me that there's all sorts of sort of legends about birds that, you know, are similar with or connected to or later seen as relatives of the albatross that sort of percolate mm-hmm. in and out of the lore. I don't know in the Middle Ages, but certainly in the classical period, because there's this bird mm-hmm. that Pliny calls the bird of Diomedes or the Diomedean bird.
Which is interesting, Ian, because when Carl Linnaeus goes to name the albatross in the 18th century, he uses that legend from Pliny to generate the Latin genus name, which is Diomedes, for the albatross.
We don't know why Linnaeus did this. So Linnaeus and then a guy named Reichenbach, like about a century later, you know, came up with the modern Latin names for the birds that we know as the albatross. And you're right, Linnaeus calls them the Diomedea, right? Like they're the Diomedean birds. So clearly Linnaeus, you know, was aware of the earlier traditions and assigned that name, knowing that it was already connected with a bird in the early mm-hmm. natural histories. So the Diomedean bird or the bird of Diomedes, which is always represented as being a large bird that lives on the islands of Diomedes, which are the Tremiti archipelago, which is right next to Italy mm-hmm. in the Adriatic. So just a tiny little mm-hmm. bunch of islands offshore. It's possible that the bird that they were actually referring to is something called Cory's Shearwater, which is a large seabird, which might, I mean, it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's not as big as an albatross, but it's certainly a large, you know, unusual seabird, which no longer lives there or anywhere in the Mediterranean, but did briefly, you know, was like on that particular archipelago. So there's this mm-hmm. there's this bird, which is called the bird of Diomedes, which is rare, referred to usually by virtue of the myth of the legends about Diomedes, who is one of the Greek heroes in the Trojan War. But these days, I think Diomedes is not nearly as famous as Diomedes once was. So if you think of the Trojan War, you know, you think of Achilles and Hector or Agamemnon, you know, mm-hmm. Menelaus, all those characters.
Odysseus, yeah.
But Diomedes is one of the...
yeah, yeah.
Yes, Odysseus, yes. Diomedes is one of those, you know, is a big hero. And, you know, he has moments where he just goes on a rampage. And most famously, he wounds Aphrodite. So, like, he actually, you know, wounds mm-hmm. one of the gods who gets caught up in the fighting. And that's why he's sort of a famous hero. But it's also why he is sort of pursued for the rest of his life, never gets to really go home, unlike Odysseus, and is connected with the bird, because there's the legend that the gods turned his followers into birds as a punishment for his behavior. There's also some legends that maybe they were turned into right. birds after his death as a kind of a tribute, so that they would continue to, like, you know, mourn his death as seabirds. But for whatever reason, the birds of Diomedes are literally supposed to be Diomedes's human followers turned into birds.
So interesting, because you think about, like, this idea of the migratory pelagic bird, you know, this bird that nests in places that people don't inhabit, you know, like these remote islands in the ocean. And so they sort of appear and disappear mysteriously, often brought in close to shore on storm winds. Maybe sailors see them out in the open ocean, that kind of thing. They carry a lot of mystery with them for people. And certainly in Old Norse and Old English literature, which, you know, these were seafaring cultures, they associate these pelagic birds with the souls of the dead, with these kind of wandering souls. So you can see a kind of through line from Diomedes to, say, something like the Old English poem, The Wanderer, which, you know, talks about a warrior who's gone away from home, and when he comes home, everything's changed. He can't find his old drinking companions, his old sort of boon companions. And he talks about the sort of seabirds as being like ghosts, who are the ghosts of his friends, crying in the wind and bathing on the storm-tossed waves. It's very evocative.
It's interesting to see, you know, even so Virgil is one of the people who refers to the Diomedes story, and it's so mm-hmm. similar to the wanderer in the Exeter book, because he says, this is Diomedes mm-hmm. says, even now visitations pursue me, dreadful to see my lost comrades as birds sought the sky with their wings or haunt the streams. Alas, a dire punishment for my people, and fill the cliffs with their mournful cries. Well, seabirds do have mournful cries, you know, mm-hmm. And they do sort of haunt the streams, meaning that, you know, like the ocean, the currents of the ocean and whatnot. So you could see how this would occur. But it's also, it's interesting that the spirits that they represent are the spirits that are usually close to the observer, right? They're your comrades or your kinship, mm. your kin, your lost kin, mm. or whatever it is that brings them close to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. But these aren't albatrosses. You know,
they aren't albatrosses. But Linnaeus never really explained why he decided to call the albatross Diomedea as the name for the family. And also why he called the main one that he wanted to locate as Diomedea exilans, which means literally the wandering Diomedean bird, which is now referred to as mm-hmm. the wandering albatross. And you'd think mm-hmm. that, well, you know, albatrosses cross large areas, right? Like if there is a wandering bird, it's going to be the albatross, right? That's what they do. They wander. So that, you mm-hmm. know, maybe he was referring to, you know, to that. But he did not have either a specimen or any personal knowledge of the natural history of the albatross when he came up with the name. So, like, we know that he called it Diomedea excellens. Oh, and also, he adds a penguin into the genus. So, you know, like, it's not, he's not thinking of it as in the albatross way that we think about it, right? So that he calls it the wandering albatross, or the wandering Diomedean bird, because he's thinking about Diomedes mm-hmm. as a wanderer or an exile, because these are the terms that are used for the story in Virgil and all the other stories.
Do we know where the name albatross comes from?
Well, that goes back to a bird that we have already talked about, which is the pelican, which was also called the Alcatraz in the Spanish language. Although today, Alcatraz in Spanish, the Alcatraz is the gannet, which is a large pelagic bird.
One of these
bird,
large white sea birds. For. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're confusing. You know, the early mariners are seeing large seabirds, and there's a lot of confusion between what they're seeing. They're not ornithologists, right? So there's the frigate bird, which is a giant pelagic bird that also flies solitary flight long, you know, overhead. That they use the term for. There's the pelican, which is called the Alcatraz, but the Alcatraz becomes the albatross, right? So it's like a corruption of the term.
Okay.
To turn it into the albatross. Then there's the other species, the other genuses of albatross, which again mm-hmm. are kind of given names by this guy Reichenbach 100 years later. And he gives them, he comes up with two genuses, one called Phibastria and one called Phibetria. So he makes up these names from classical sources, and the words mean prophetess, a female prophet.
Oh, interesting. I see.
Again, no explanation, but it is possible. So there's a possible explanation for this, which is a lot of albatrosses are dark, are a kind of a gray color. Sometimes we think of them as white, but there's a lot of albatross species that are basically like they're gray. And at the time, that gray color was associated with Quakers because they always dressed in gray.
Oh, interesting.
So they were called the Quaker birds. Right? The Quakers were also associated with prophecy and particularly with female prophecy. So we think possibly Reichenbach was using, you know, like taking the Quaker birds and turning them into the classical version of that.
Interesting kind of loop, a historical loop around these birds as they start to reveal themselves to Europeans in the, you know, 18th and 19th century. Do we know what the earliest recorded European notation of a bird that might be an albatross? Do we know what that is, or?
It's about the time that they were referred to as an albatross. And as you might imagine, it's when they first began visiting the Southern Ocean. So we're talking early 18th century, you know, long before Coleridge wrote The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. The story on which he based that poem is a sailor named. So the account is by a guy named Captain Shelvock. But the sailor's name is Simon Hartley. So Shelvock wrote this book called A Voyage Around the World in 1726. He mentions an albatross, and he mentions a story of one of his sailors, Simon Hartley, shooting this albatross because he thought it was a bird of bad omen and that it would, you know, shooting it would improve the weather. Simon Hartley was later lost at sea and picked up by a Spanish ship and possibly tortured by the Inquisition.
How did that work out for him?
Did not work out for him.
Yeah. So I guess you shouldn't.
Yeah.
That it's a conservationist message for the ages.
Yeah.
Don't shoot large pelagic seabirds. Just don't. Don't do it.
Just don't. So it's like it's a corruption of Alcatraz, but it's a corruption which is established by like two or three people.
Fascinating. You know, that this hitherto unknown creature appears. And as people do, you put it into a kind of category or a nomenclature that is pre-existing. Like you can fit it into a whole, not just the nomenclature, but like a whole sort of mythological tradition around these wandering birds and Diomedes. Like you assimilate it basically to your cultural understanding of natural phenomena. And so in a way, even though the Middle Ages doesn't have, you know, the bird that we recognize in modern ornithology as the albatross, it has albatrosses. They're always there. Just they're not the modern bird. And it's this whole thing we're constantly dealing with when we're talking about fantastic beasts, right? Ian, like, are we talking about biological species that we recognize today, or are we talking about ideas about animals and ideas about the relationship between the divine, the human, the bestial? I think it really opens up those questions in interesting ways, sort of from the other end than we've typically been approaching them.
Yes, because with other animals, we can say, well, you know, to what extent are they aware of the real animal? They could have been, maybe they were, how closely, you know, like how much did they know about pelicans? All that kind of question, because they certainly could have seen them. But the albatross is a great test case because they literally could not really have encountered the albatross until that period in the early 18th century. And yet they, you know, the legend and myth is prefabricated, right? Like it's so easy for them to slot that bird into this legendary, you know, history, which then becomes, you know, an inspiration for poets, right? So there's the lost soul thing, right, which clearly goes way back. And then there's the sort of prophetic aspect of seabirds, because after all, they travel based on the wind, so they will appear with certain winds and certain weather conditions. which meant that they were often seen as prophetic of those weather conditions, right? So like the albatrosses show up, you know, this is going to happen in the weather, or we are this close to land, right? Because you're encountering these birds in their native habitat. So they're even perceived as prophetic in ways that we wouldn't think of as sort of magical in any way, right? They're just like they show up in these circumstances. And today, you know, the albatross is often seen as like an index of the effects of human activity in the ocean, right? So like we measure our impact in the ocean by virtue of the number of albatrosses that we're, you know, destroying, sadly, these days. So we still see the albatross as prophetic in its own way. Yeah,
I mean, it's an index species. So that's just another way of saying that, isn't it?
And the legend becomes so powerful, particularly because of the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, right? So like that poem is so famous and is learned by so many school children that it kind of creates the legendary inertia. There's a great story of this Dr. John Singleton is going to Melbourne, and he observes this incident where a sailor, as they're heading into the Southern Ocean, is drunk, comes out on deck, sees an albatross land on the railing, and then, you know, disappear, i.e. flying off, right? He hallucinates. He says that he has shot the albatross, and he promptly throws himself into the sea and is never seen again. He was really, really drunk.
That's interesting. Yeah, the way in which the animal becomes almost a kind of externalized image of some interior mental state for this drunk and I'm sure suicidally depressed sailor, you know, that's fascinating. That and the fact that, you know, the albatross becomes kind of the sign that you've crossed over from the world as you know it, the world of the Northern Hemisphere, right, to the topsy-turvy upside down world of the Southern Hemisphere. The albatross becomes kind of the gatekeeper or the symbol of that passage from one life to another, one hemisphere to another.
You know, the real life albatross is a fantastic creature, and I mean, absolutely fantastic bird.
Yeah, and an ancient bird too. I mean, when you see an albatross, they have this. They look like one of those birds that you see like in a natural history museum with the sort of jointed wings and the flying dinosaurs. I mean, they're not dinosaurs, I know, but they were.
But they're able to do apparently some things that a lot of other birds can't do.
Such as?
Well, they can lock their wings when they're gliding, and apparently they can glide for 600 miles between wing, you know, before they have to actually flap and do anything about that. So
that's impressive.
That's a long, long, impressive glide. And they have shown that their heart rate when they're gliding is the resting heart rate. So like their gliding is no more, takes no more energy than sitting on the surface of the water, which means they, you know, they probably sleep while they're gliding. They have tubes in their nose, which act like these little tubes that we've now put in airplanes to give wind speed. They're called pitot tubes. So they know that the albatross, as it's flying, can have like its brain is getting very, very exact wind speed indications, which is one reason why it can glide so well, because you need to know what the wind is doing if you're going to glide like that. And then their nesting is they have to be 10 years old before they are mature enough to nest at all. And they don't lay an egg every year because it takes them a year from laying the egg to fledging that baby. A whole year they have to spend. Wow. On that, and they only lay one egg.
Yeah, so that probably makes them really, really vulnerable, you know, in terms of sustaining. Like a massive storm or a predation event where, you know, a bunch of sailors climb up and steal their eggs or, you know, something like that. Yep. I know that they were at one time on Easter Island, there was a huge colony of albatrosses, but before European contact, Polynesian hunting on the island wiped out that colony. So In Japanese mythology, one of the names for them is ahodori, which means that it means sort of stupid bird or fool bird, because they're not really afraid of predators, because most of the places that they nest, they have no predators. And so when they're on the ground, they're very vulnerable. If they land someplace, there are predators. So they're just, you know, they're not evolutionarily equipped to deal with predation particularly.
So some of the names in English are also reflect that foolishness. The term goonie bird, which is a term for an albatross, comes from its being silly. And then there's there's a species that is very closely related to the albatross called the mollymock, which is specifically that name is a name for foolishness.
Right. And it's interesting because, like, you know, this is obviously not medieval or even early modern, but the poet Baudelaire, the French poet Charles Baudelaire, has a poem called The Albatross. And in it, he compares the poet to the albatross because, like, when he's flying, he's like the king of the clouds. But when he's on the ground, his like giant wings make it impossible for him to walk. So the idea that the poet is this like master of the nebulous, but on solid ground, he's kind of helpless and a loser.
Yeah.
So that contrast between the elegance of the bird that can glide for days versus the bird that can barely walk around on its awkward webbed feet.
Which is, I mean, this is the reason that albatrosses are threatened or endangered. Almost, you know, all the species of albatross are threatened. Some are endangered and really headed for extinction. Things like long line fishing is it's terrible for albatrosses because they think that the bait is a fish and then they get caught and they drown. When they nest, so they nest. They only nest every other year because it takes the year to have the baby. And if, unlike other birds, if they lay an egg and the egg is damaged for some reason or destroyed or stolen, whatever, they won't try again that year, right? Like they try once with one egg. And unlike other birds where if you take the eggs, they'll just keep laying until they get a nest. They give up. They're like, well, that's it for this year. We'll come try again next year, right? And it's off they go. The reproduction rate seems really slow. So it's a good thing that they're so long lived and that they can keep laying eggs into their 70s because they need to.
Right. Yeah. Especially, you know, where they don't, I mean, you said, you know, they, once they're fledged, they don't get any parental sort of enculturation. Everything has to be based on instinct, and apparently they will not nest or breed. Some of them don't even build nests. But they won't breed anywhere that, like, most of them won't breed more than about 50 meters from the place where they themselves.
Yes.
So they're very,
because that they can get
for
back
a
there.
Wandering bird. Yeah, for a wandering bird, they're really homebodies when it comes to where they choose to do their reproductive activity.
You can circle the globe and come back to this tiny little island where you were born. And oh, by the way, they don't drink fresh water. They drink seawater.
Well, that makes sense, right?
Yeah. And they
where would they find
they have an
fresh
organ
water?
In their in their beak that all birds have, but it's only active in certain seabirds like the albatross, where it can extract the salt from the water. And then, you know, so they have brine sort of dripping from their nose all the time because they're constantly turning salt water into fresh water.
Kind of disgusting, but also fantastic. you're not making it up when you say these are fantastical beasts.
Yes, I mean, they are.
They're really something else. And you know, they really do have that appearance of, you know, great antiquity, which evolutionarily speaking is correct, right? I mean, they're one of the older species of birds out there. And they also, I think, pair bond, right, for life, more or less.
They do. Yeah, they will divorce if they suffer multiple seasons in which the eggs don't hatch. Apparently.
Okay. This really isn't working out,
it
honey.
It takes a while. It takes a while. Yeah.
You keep rolling sort of like, the egg off the cliff. I'm not...
like Henry VIII, right?
Yeah. Hopefully it's an amicable divorce. Well, Ian, this has certainly been a bit of a departure from our usual investigation of animals that were, if not familiar, at least accepted and understood within a certain framework in the Middle Ages. Here we're talking about an animal that was completely alien, but it's been really interesting. And these are birds worth paying attention to, as long as we have them.
Yeah, I will say our ornithology episodes are they're very interesting about teaching us precise things about how the fantastic and the real relate to each other in kind of in animal studies.
And also the sea. Like anytime we're dealing with sea creatures, it seems like we really get into this territory of the inherently mysterious.
Yeah.
Like the creatures of the land don't quite offer the same degree of fantasy, really, as the creatures of these realms in which humans themselves are aliens.
So we passengers. Should do more fish more seabirds.
More, and not just fish. Anything that lives in or on or above the sea.
All right, then. Until next time.
All right. Until next time.
If you have questions or comments or suggestions about future episodes, we would love to hear from you. Just go to realfantasticbeasts.com and you will find lots of ways to join the conversation.